This is Aurelia.
And this is Damien.
Welcome to the Breakfast of Ideas podcast, a series presented in collaboration with the Center for Information Technology, Society and Law and the Digital Society Initiative at the University of Zurich. It was a great pleasure to have Christoph Lutz present at the Breakfast of Ideas. Christoph is an associate professor at the Department of Communication and Culture at the Nordic Center for Internet and Society, BI Norwegian Business School. His areas of expertise include digital work, the sharing economy, privacy, and social robots. In his talk, Christoph presented his interdisciplinary research on the chilling effects of profiling activities. In this publication, he investigates together with colleagues how profiling activities of corporations influence the behavior of individuals and, in particular, chill activities online. Without further ado, you can now listen to Christoph's full talk. Enjoy!
Thank you. Thank you very much for the nice introduction. So today, as Aurelia mentioned, I will talk about chilling effects of profiling activities. I will present you the work in progress of this paper that we are doing at the moment. I also quickly want to acknowledge the other co-authors of this work who are not here today, but Shruti Velidi. She's a colleague from the United States, and she was doing a Fulbright visiting research fellowship in Oslo last year and this year, the beginning of the year. She's now back in the United States, in San Francisco, but she has a background in cognitive psychology, I think, or cognitive sciences, so psychology, and also social sciences. And then we also have Eduard Foch-Viaronga. He's a very good collaborator and friend of both Aurelia and me, and he's a law and technology scholar, so he has a background in law, but he's working a lot on robotics and robots and the legal challenges of social robots. So he's also a really good collaborator and friend. And finally, Salome Viljoen is also a co-author with us. She is at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, and also brings in her expertise in American law and comparative law. So I will not talk very much about the legal aspects, only very briefly, because I'm not the expert in that regard among our co-authors. But that's the team that we are working with on this research. If you are interested in reading more, we also have this paper available as a working paper. It's currently also under review at a journal. Hopefully it should be out maybe next year or in the next couple of months. But you will find it if you Google for the title Chilling Effects of Profiling Activities Mapping the Issues. And there is a lot more to that, I mean, in terms of the references and the background and the different definitions that I won't have enough time to go in too much detail today. So the plan for my talk is first I will give a short introduction to the topic. I will discuss a case or an example for chilling effects of corporate profiling. In the second part, I will talk more about big data and database surveillance, which is kind of the background of this research. I will then go into profiling as one specific type of surveillance. We'll offer a definition. I will talk more about different types and application areas of profiling. After that, I will then talk about chilling effects, since the paper is about chilling effects, and I will connect the literature about chilling effects to the literature about profiling. I will explain what chilling effects are. I will talk you through different streams of literature. And then in the later parts, I will really try to make the link between these areas. I will offer different propositions how research could investigate these phenomena, because as we saw when we did the literature review and the in-depth search, we didn't find really much literature on corporate profiling and chilling effects. We did find more on state surveillance and government surveillance and chilling effects, and also on peer surveillance and chilling effects, but really not very much about corporate surveillance. So that's going to be the later part. So I just want to start with an example that we also use in the paper. This is based on a Wall Street Journal article that was published, I think, in January this year, so a couple of months ago, about New York life insurance companies. And in that article, it says that these companies will now be able to access people's social media feeds, for example, their Instagram data, and can then use that type of information for making judgments and evaluations what type of premiums they should get. So the insurance rates can be determined based on people's data profiles. So in that article, then they also describe what type of consequences that might have for people, or how people can kind of take advantage of the situation in terms of what they should post on Instagram and what they shouldn't post. So this is kind of the suggestion: don't post photos of yourself smoking on social media sites. I mean, that's maybe something we are already aware of, that we shouldn't really do that. But then also stuff like, do post photos of yourself running. Riskier sports like skydiving could complicate the situation. So here, already a bit more of a strong behavioral encouragement or stimulus. Use fitness tracking devices that indicate an interest in fitness. What if you don't want to use Fitbit or Apple Watch or similar types of devices? And purchase food from online meal preparation services that specialize in healthy choices. Of course, for those of you who have been in the US and went to an organic supermarket, you know that it's very expensive. Not everyone might be able to afford going to these places and really buy the super healthy food. And finally, visit the gym with a phone linked to a location tracking device. If you visit the bar, leave your phone at home. So you see, all of these things are really trying to make people healthier and more aware human beings in a way, but also come with certain behavioral modifications that people need to adapt and change their behavior because these insurance companies now have access to their social media feeds and can set insurance premiums based on that. So this is really a good example for what we are interested in, because the main research question that we have in this research is really, do profile activities such as those that I described with the insurance companies, do they really lead to chilling effects? Chilling effects here is really understood as behavioral restraint, behavioral modification in the sense that people don't do something they would normally do. For example, in the case of if someone is smoking and would normally post pictures of themselves in a bar, and then based on the knowledge and the assumption that they are being watched and surveilled, stops to do that. So that's the question. It's a very simple question when you look at it first, but as it turns out, it's actually much, much more complex if you go into more depth and into the literature, because there are many different challenges related to finding out about this. First of all, because we are talking about a relatively broad thing like behavioral modification or self-restraint, we can also think of other types of reasons why people do that. Maybe people change location and move to a different place and change their lifestyle because of that. So there are many confounding factors. So empirically, it is not very easy to really find out whether profiling activities really lead to chilling effects. So that's, but keep in mind the question, because I'm trying to now disentangle a bit the different parts of the question. First, what I will explain what we mean by profiling activities. So when it comes to profiling, we kind of embed this topic or this phenomenon into the broader literature on surveillance. I'm sure you're familiar with some of the literature about privacy, maybe about surveillance, capitalism, maybe also about profiling, but still I think it's helpful to kind of give you a short overview of some of the issues we are dealing with here. So we have seen a shift, I would say, in online surveillance, at least in the last 15 to 20 years, with the advent of big data, algorithms and machine learning. So first of all, we see an increase in the data that is available about us. We leave traces whenever we do something on a device. And this data is being collected, is being analyzed and being mined and being used for different purposes like targeted advertising. So the scope of the data that we leave has increased substantially. keep seeing these statistics that say like, oh, this year we produce more data than in the whole history up to 1995 or something like that. So these kind of numbers are always floating around. And another fundamental difference, I think, when it comes to online surveillance and the shift in this paradigm is certainly that it's a more inductive approach. I mean, many of us are used to this typical deductive approach in the social sciences, where we start with a theory, we then try to make the theory into a hypothesis, or operationalize the theory, then collect data based on these hypotheses and the theory, and then kind of make assumptions or make claims whether the theory is supported or not. So it's kind of going from theory to a hypothesis, to the data, and then to the conclusions. Whereas in the inductive approach, you really start with the data. You just try to get as much data as you can, and then you will try to exploratorily search for patterns in that data, not really based on theories or assumptions, but just on based on what the data shows you and tells you. So that's the inductive approach. And finally, also the platformization of society. We see we are spending increasing amounts of times in kind of these platforms. Facebook, certainly a good example. But you also see commercial platforms like Airbnb and Uber that are becoming increasingly data hungry and collecting a lot of data about people's very private lives. And then some authors like Jose van Dijk, they've talked about data valence as a new term, so a combination of data or big data and surveillance. Nick Caldry as well, he has a new book out that is about this topic and data colonialism. But here in the paper, we kind of distinguish different types of data, which different types of data that go into data valence. Of course, we leave voluntary data. If we are posting something on social media or even writing an email, this is kind of data that we consciously create by doing it ourselves. So this data is being mined and used, of course, but it's only maybe a small part or a very small part of the actual data that is created. What we shouldn't forget is also data created by other people about us. So other people might tag us on social media. If you're a business, people might write reviews. They might make YouTube videos, especially celebrities, of course. Target of this data created by other people. But even ordinary people, if someone Googles your name and tries to find out more, this is kind of leaving a data trace that you are not really leaving yourself, but that someone else leaves about you. So this is the data created by other people about us, but the large chunk is really the metadata. So data that kind of comes as a byproduct of our online activities. Think of device. So whenever you, or location, whenever you go somewhere and you have location tracking activated, you will have kind of leave a data trace that shows where you were. Device information is saved, and these kind of configurations are used for profiling and targeting as well. So the phenomenon, as I mentioned, that we are most interested in the paper is the one highlighted here, which we call profiling. But we can also think of a lot of different configurations of surveillance that are kind of adjacent or related, but maybe not, I mean, not directly what we are looking at in the paper. So profiling really is kind of a cooperation doing the action and activity, and the user being the target of this activity. So here you can read the rows as kind of the actor that creates the surveillance or is responsible for surveillance, and the column would be the target of the surveillance. So you could also, for example, think of the contrary when companies are being watched, like in the sense of a watchdog by civil society or by individuals. So this would be user to corporations, which you see at the bottom in the middle, which is happening, for example, with Electronic Frontier Foundation and similar types of initiatives that try to reverse the picture and actually reveal responsibility gaps, consumer rights issues, and do what we sometimes collect surveillance. Actually, people are switching the script and watching from below. But here, what I'm going to talk about now is really this profiling, where we are interested in corporations. Think of Facebook. You can also think of these life insurance companies. And the individuals are the targets, so people like you and me. So the definition that we use is actually based on work by Hildebrandt. She was influential when it comes to profiling. Also Bosco et al. And the definition is the automated processing of data aggregated from multiple sources related to an individual is termed profiling. And the purpose is developing predictive knowledge to be used for future decision making. So you see, profiling contains three main elements. First of all, it's normally automated. At least the most the largest chunk of profiling activities are now being done automatically. You might still have a little bit of human impact and influence sometimes, but the largest part is really happening without human intervention and control. Data is really aggregated across sources, is combined. Often you have data brokers that acquire data from one source, sell it to another source, and therefore entities are able to create very sophisticated profiles. So the aggregation is an important element. And also that it's data about people, about individuals. So it's not really data about a collective or society as a whole. It's really data about someone, a specific person. The purpose, as mentioned here, is predictive. Normally, the goal is to predict something, like the interest or the credit rating of someone. The insurance premiums someone has, or the likelihood that they will default a loan in financial terms in the court trial. It could be the likelihood that they will reoffend. So recidivism rates are something that they try to predict and based on profiling. But there are a lot of different examples, which I'm going to talk about a bit more. And one example that is quite interesting and striking is actually Google. Google is probably the one company that has, or the one entity that has most data about most of us, at least in the West. And this was based also on a Wall Street Journal article where the journalist, I think he's called Tom Gara, downloaded his whole Google data. And you can also do that if you're interested in what Google has about you. Based on the GDPR, you now have the right to access your personal data. It's probably several gigabytes large. When I did it, it was a huge data file and very complex, since Google has all these different services. But here I just found it extreme and striking just how much data was available. So you see 134,966 emails or chat conversations through Gmail. It's like really, really massive. Of course, Google searches that are many times very personal and kind of reveal people's most secret fantasies and interests. Android, since Android is part of Google, all these devices are being tracked. Docs, working in Google Docs. Many of us clearly will use Google Docs, and everything you write there is also part of the profile that you leave. Maybe the most interesting or funny thing, it's a bit small here, but if you see location, it says due to an unknown glitch, Google bases Tom's location from one of his old Android phones, which he gave to his mother in Australia. So this means even though that they might be able to really track almost every move you do, there might still be glitches in many cases, or people obfuscate the data willingly. What you also see is that, for example, location data can be very imprecise. So even here, in this case, where the complete location that he leaves might be not about him, but about his mother, and therefore not really accurate. So I mentioned this example of Google. But we also see the life insurance example at the beginning, where profiles are being used for determining insurance rates and premiums. This is happening in the United States. I'm not so sure how much is happening here in Europe. Advertising is maybe a key application of profiling. So whenever you see a targeted ad, it's due to the data traces you leave. Google is also very advanced in that regard, trying to combine different data sources beyond what they already have. MasterCard, for example, they purchased MasterCard data, like I think 70 million, or records from 70 million people in the United States. Whenever they bought something with a MasterCard credit card, Google now knows where they bought this and what they bought, and can of course use that for more sophisticated targeted advertising. The creditworthiness is one big area where credit rates are being determined based on different inputs, also consumer data and online data. One company we quickly discussed is called FriendlyScore. They harness social media data to create scorecard profiles of users, which are used to determine creditworthiness. Then we see more and more sophisticated applications in human resource management, on hiring decisions, that companies collect background information about applications and applicants. And there are things like HireVue, which is like a relatively big startup by now that uses facial recognition technology and AI to really determine how well someone performs in a job interview and whether they are a suitable candidate for a role. This is also happening mostly automatically. So instead of speaking to a recruiter or to a human, you have to speak into your computer, and then it's going to be analyzed what you say and how you say it and what facial expressions you have. Criminal activity, this has been one of the most discussed cases in the United States, where you have a software called Compass, which is used to predict recidivism, so whether people will reoffend. And it was shown that this software is biased against Black and African Americans, so that they are more likely to be shown to reoffend, even though they might not actually do that in reality. Whereas white people, even though if they have a criminal record and are in a way dangerous, were shown to be harmless. So this is a software that was discussed by ProPublica and very strongly criticized for racial bias and also gender bias. And finally, social scoring. I'm sure you've heard of the social credit system in China. China is creating a social credit scoring system that citizens, based on what they do online and offline, based on quite a few different sources, receive a score, how trustworthy they are. I think from 0 to 900 in the most used version of the credit score. And then based on how well you rank, you will get certain sanctions. So if you are seen as untrustworthy, you might not be allowed to leave the country or to even board a train or even to take an inland flight. So there will be quite strong social implications based on this social credit scoring system. So you see actually this is an issue or phenomenon across different social domains. Discussion is very US focused at the moment. You see many of these cases are based on the United States. So I think we have would be nice to have a few more European perspectives here. And based on the law, this is something we do in more depth in the paper, where we compare the different legislations, especially the GDPR and the European Data Protection Regulation, which kind of governs profiling in Europe. And the United States laws. We see that in Europe this is more explicitly protected via the GDPR, which has certain passages on automated decision making and profiling as well. Whereas in the US this is more based on sector specific laws such as the Children Online Privacy Protection Act or COPPA or HIP or the health. If you leave health data, this is governed by HIPAA, like Health Insurance Protection Act. So there are more sector-specific laws, but not so much overarching laws that govern it, also based more on states. So California just passed probably the most advanced and most consumer-friendly privacy protection law. And also in the US, it's more a topic of anti-discrimination laws. But as we argue in the paper, also these anti-discrimination laws don't offer the necessary protection because they have certain loopholes. Also the GDPR, since GDPR is about personal data, and some companies might try to avoid basically making data personally identifiable or making it automated by having a human in the loop. But GDPR also tries to kind of close these loopholes that companies try to come up with. Overall, I would say the European Union, we have more a better protection against profiling, against automated decision making, and also better transparency in that regard, or better rights to transparency at least in that regard. So this is profiling, and I want to talk about some of the behavioral consequences. We briefly talk about customization. So if you think back at the beginning, the example of the Wall Street Journal, some of the points that they recommended were customization. So you should go more to the fitness center, but you should leave your phone at home when you go to the bar. This is kind of adapting your behavior based on profiling or surveillance. I think we talk about behavioral modification to refer to general behavioral changes. Or customization is more or less a synonym that we use. But the type we are most interested in is really deterrence or inhibition, so that people fail to do something they would otherwise do, or censor themselves, or become more restrained. That's kind of the idea of chilling effects. So chilling effects really refer to deterrence, inhibition, or restraint, as opposed to people doing more than they would normally do to maybe get perceived in a better way. So this idea of deterrence, inhibition, or restraint is very prominent in chilling effects theory. So this is a body of theory that was developed from the 1970s on, especially in law. So you find a lot of legal literature. Initially, it was seen as kind of due to regulation or certain laws make people less politically engaged, and certain laws make people use their freedom of opinion and expression less. So in the United States, this is very much tied to the freedom of expression and freedom of opinion, and also the fear, I mean, in a liberal sense, that too much legislation and regulation will make people passive and not so engaged in terms of speaking out. The definition we use is kind of based on a more modern or more or broader concept of chilling effects. We use this study by Marder and colleagues, who define chilling effects as impact of surveillance by audiences on constraining behavior. So here it's the term constraining behavior, that you constrain yourself because of surveillance normally. And there are different ways that this constraining behavior can occur. Self-censorship is a prominent one, and you find some literature in communication research about a spiral of silence, which is a process that people, if they see that they are in a minority and everyone else has a different opinion, start to silence themselves and don't speak up so much anymore. This is something that has been investigated on social media. The people think, oh, everyone else is not interested in what I'm saying, so I might as well shut up and not post anything anymore. Conformity is also a concern, that if everyone has fear of being surveilled, it will lead to a conformist society where you don't have any outliers and mavericks anymore. So there are a lot of different fears related to this constraining behavior. And what we see is that traditional chilling effects literature from law is very much based on the state and state surveillance. Therefore, you also have quite a kind of a renaissance of interest in that phenomenon after Snowden and the PRISM leaks, which made public that there is mass surveillance of citizens. So you see the initial text that I mentioned was the one by Schauer, is kind of the birth of the chilling effect theory, often seen as kind of the key text in the legal domain. But then in terms of data valence and big data-based surveillance, Penny studies is the one we really like and kind of discuss in a bit more depth. And he could show that people actually silence themselves after finding out that this mass data collection is taking place. As Deutschev, this is also a very interesting study that experimentally with an experiment could show that if people are being confronted that their data is being collected and profiled by the government and by the state, they will not be as outspoken politically. They will not be as much. And they then also did a study with Muslim Americans or Muslims in the US and could show that this was especially the case among minorities. So state surveillance has been shown to lead to chilling effects. The same is true for peer surveillance. So your neighbor or your friend or your partner or someone else, or maybe someone you don't know, but a specific person watches you, or you have the perception that they watch you, you will probably be more restrained. In that regard, the study by Marder is interesting. They showed if people at a party, if someone is trying to take a picture of you and says it will be on Facebook or Instagram, you will put your drink away and you don't want to be seen drinking. So he could show this type of restraint in real life settings, also through a good experiment. But the big hole here, or the big gap that we saw when we looked at the literature across different fields, was that there's almost nothing on corporate surveillance. Because normally, I mean, often the classical example is the panopticon by Foucault, it's saying, okay, in that scenario, the prisoners know that they are being watched or that they might be watched. So the awareness is kind of an important aspect. And in these studies, the ones on Snowden, I think they show that by now about 80 or 90% know that this mass surveillance is taking place. So it seems like awareness is happening, maybe slowly, and maybe differently across different groups. But it's something that is kind of a precondition for people to then change their behavior. And in many cases, the examples I made earlier, I think many people don't know that this happens. So they might also not change their behavior accordingly. Yes, so the proposition, this is actually something that then, I mean, the lack of literature on corporate profiling and chilling effects, what led us to propose five propositions. First of all, we said we need to have more research on this topic. It's kind of an important topic, and there's very little evidence and knowledge. So we should, in general, have more research on that, and we encourage everyone to look into this in more depth. Then it should also be studied. I mean, initially, probably the way we approach it, it's good to start simple and look into profiling by corporations and that maybe directly chilling effects, whether they occur or not. But in a second step, this could also be enhanced by looking at the surveillance ecosystem more broadly, by looking at third parties, data brokers, and other stakeholders within this network, and also at users' agency. What can people actually do to avoid being chilled? We think this phenomenon should be studied across domains. We saw insurance, the financial area is important here, but there are other domains as well that are really important. And we could compare whether people are more chilled when much is at stake, for example, when it's decided whether they will get a loan or not, or whether it also occurs in kind of low-risk scenarios, where it's maybe not so much of a direct strong life outcome that's at stake. Then we think there should be a social justice and social inequalities perspective on this, because it might be the ones, or it is probably the ones that are already heavily targeted in the United States. low socioeconomic status groups and racial minorities are often more heavily targeted by the state in terms of surveillance. And these are also the groups that might face the most consequences in terms of chilling effects. So we think this should be a group or a kind of a lens that would be very valuable. And finally, in the legal terms, more comparative research is needed. Also going beyond the European and US law, what does it look like in other countries in the global south? What do these different legislation offer in terms of protection? Next steps, this is what we are doing right now. We are now working on a survey to really find out more about corporate profiling and user perception. So we want to know, what do users know? Is there broad awareness? What kind of profiling are they aware of and do they know? We are thinking of working with kind of a type of application. For example, Facebook ad preferences could be a good case because Facebook shows you which types of attributes they think you have or which groups you belong to demographically, but also psychographically, whether you are interested in animals or cats or dogs or whatever. So you can actually go on Facebook and see your profile in that sense. So our idea is to use that application and to see whether people find that concerning or surprising in any way. And then in another step, we also want to do a maybe experimental confirmatory study that really allows us to test whether corporate profiling leads to chilling effects. So that's the status quo.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for the invitation.
You've just heard from Christoph Lutz, Associate Professor at the Department of Communication and Culture and at the Nordic Center for Internet and Society, BI Norwegian Business School in Oslo. On behalf of Damien and myself, thank you for listening to the Breakfast of Ideas podcast, a co-production of the Center for Information Technology, Society and Law and the Digital Society Initiative at the University of Zurich. Editing, mixing and music by Eric Lariot. The production team would like to thank the graduate campus of the University of Zurich for funding the Breakfast of Ideas seminars in this podcast series.